Welcome back to Too Much Future, the show where Cameron and I play through the Fallout games. I'm Michael.
Right before we recorded, I said, Michael, I don't remember the intro. And he said, oh, it's this. I said, oh, it's great. And we made it through it.
Yeah, we did. That's Cameron. Since he didn't introduce himself, that could have just been anyone. Like, there could have been a third person on this call who just jumped in.
It's a pirate radio, and they beep their way in, and it's Max Headroom, and no one knows who did it. 30 years on, the mystery of Too Much Future, Season 2, Episode 1. Because it's Season 2, Michael.
Yeah, this is Season 2. Season 2 for Fallout 2.
Mm-hmm. It is. We've gotten a lot of questions about, what games are we playing? Fallout 1. Mm-hmm. Easy, we've done that one already.
Oh, you meant for the show. I thought you meant like in general. I was like, I don't know why people care.
Well, we know you've been playing Alien Isolation.
Yes.
Fallout 1, Fallout 2, obviously. But then people are saying, what are we doing next? Fallout Tactics? Fallout Brotherhood of Steel? Fallout 3? And the answer is, we still don't know. So you can keep asking, but we still don't know.
Yeah, we will not know. We will probably not know until like very close to the end of this game what we mm-hmm. can do or want to do.
Exactly. So just some convenient information for you there. Oh golly. Michael, it's Fallout 2. Mm-hmm. You played a lot of Fallout 2 as a youth.
Yes. Except, and here's the thing, I think I talked about this like way back in our first episode for mm-hmm. the first game. I was playing Fallout 2 during this very weird time in my life in like, I think like middle school, early high school, where over the summers I had really nothing to do. And so I would just pirate games that people on the forums that I posted on talked about a lot. And then I would marathon them. So I would know them very well for, like, that year, and then the memories would get hazier and hazier and hazier. So I played a lot of Fallout 2. I remember maybe very well three areas. Because everything else was just, like, I was, like, rushing through it to get to, like, to be able to have that experience under my belt, right? And be able to talk on the forums with all the cool people who had been gaming for much longer than I had. So this is going to be interesting because it's going to be a lot of me remembering things and also, I guess, misremembering things, probably recognizing my own misremembrances.
Yeah, I remember I had a similar experience, but only because, like, when I was playing the Fallout games, right, played Fallout 1, played Fallout 2, although I'm not 100% sure I ever completed Fallout 2, which is interesting. I know I played it a lot, but I'm not sure I ever beat the game. And the reason for that is I had Fallout 1 and I had Fallout 2, and then somewhere when I was playing Fallout 2, I got Baldur's Gate. And Fallout 2 kind of fell by the wayside a little bit due to Baldur's Gate 2. So in some ways, Mages and Murder Dads cannibalized my experience of Fallout 2. So I very similarly, I remember some sections of this game really, really well. In fact, for this episode, we played through the Temple of Trials, and I could do that with a blindfold, I think. I can tell you, like every room, I can tell you the map, everything for it. And I remember some stuff too, like when we do some of the gang stuff later with the rival gangs, I remember that really well. Mm-hmm. That's not a spoiler. There's gangs in this game.
Surprise.
But so I remember some stuff too. So I think this will be a really refreshing kind of, or literally refreshing, and then it will refresh my memory. But things that I've focused in on over the years might not be as important as I thought they were at the time, or might not be as interesting, or might not be the most interesting stuff. So I'm excited to dig back into it. You installed the game. Did you have any troubles installing the game?
Nope.
Okay. Me neither. It all worked out. I am not, for people who are watching the video feed, I am not using a widescreen mod this time. I just have the GOG.com classic Fallout, which has a screen scaling option in it. So you're seeing, you know, the original, I think the original aspect ratio of Fallout just blown up into the appropriate size, which is pretty cool, but it means we're getting less wide vistas than we did for Fallout 1.
Aw, and this is the one where I actually have the widescreen mod installed, so that's how I'm playing it.
Well, you know, sometimes we see different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. It'll be fine. I like getting the classic view a little bit. So that's totally fine. Michael, you want to start talking about the beginning of this game?
Sure. The game starts. We see the Interplay logo. Hooray. We mm-hmm. also see the Black Isle logo.
Mm-hmm.
So Black Isle is now on the scene. It is 1998?
Yes, it is 1998. Question mark. I believe it is.
We are still in mourning over Princess Diana.
Dang, did she die in 97?
97, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, 98. Yeah, you're right. So this is just a year.
Yeah, no, this game is released like a year after the previous game, which is kind of wild.
Yeah, the sheer amount of games that came out during our adolescence and childhood that were the products of unrelenting and horrifying crunch are pretty significant.
Yeah, so we get the Black Isle logo. Black Isle is a storied development studio from this time period. And we get the opening notes of our theme song for this game, which is A Kiss to Build a Dream On by Louis Armstrong. And we fade in on kind of a classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to talk about A Kiss to Build a Dream On really briefly, this is my favorite Fallout theme song.
Why is that?
I don't know, I just like it more.
Okay, I mean, I think it is a good song.
Well, it's like the other ones, all the other Fallout, like, classic 1950s-ish songs that they use, they're all, like, A Kiss to Build a Dream On is like, I'm gonna go do a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a quest outset song, where the rest of the songs that get used in Fallout are a little bit more reflective, right? They're like, mm-hmm. This is what happened to the world.
Yes.
So, you know, I don't know.
Well, it's like, yeah, the previous game was the Inkspots. That was maybe, and that was kind mm-hmm. of, you know, this wistful sort of, you know, what have we lost? What could have been? What will be? A Kiss to Build a Dream On is very much, it is not thematically close exactly, but it is appropriate to what we were about to learn about the Garden of Eden creation kit and all that mm-hmm. stuff. So mm-hmm. this idea of building a dream, because we're in this classroom and we're getting ready to watch a little educational short.
Okay, here's a question for us, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
We're about to see some Vault Boy shenanigans.
Yes.
Well, I guess I'll explain first. So these are some. Here's the Vault Boy shenanigans. Basically, this is an educational video that exists to tell us how to, like, what the appropriate procedure is to leave the vault.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget what the first one is.
the rules. Oh, so the first rule is line up in an orderly fashion.
That's right. Along those lines. That's right. So everyone gets in a line. The second one is please wear protective eyewear.
Mm-hmm. Because having been in the vault, so the other thing that this short is doing, of course, is letting someone who has not played Fallout 1 know what the hell is going on.
Yes, this is, and I don't know if they would be able to figure it out.
No, I don't think so.
You gotta read the manual or something. But yeah, and so you gotta wear protective eyewear, and then if you don't wear protective eyewear, there's like a little like, you know, Goofus and Gallant kind of thing here, mm-hmm. where, you know, the Vault Boy who doesn't wear the protective eyewear, his eyeballs are burned out of his head in a cartoon-like fashion.
Yep, they're like just big empty holes, like craters with smoke coming out of them. And also, this is like, it's like cel-shaded almost.
It's bizarre. So, especially in the lineup photograph, it's like two 2D images and then a 3D model.
Yeah.
That's the Vault Boy that's a little bit cel-shaded. I'm not quite sure what the reason for that was, rather than just animating it. But yeah, it's like a weird 3D model. And then I don't even know what the third one is.
Oh, there isn't a third one. I had to watch this like two or three times just to make sure. Because, yeah, no, they only give you two rules for leaving the vault, which is line up in an orderly fashion and wear protective eyewear.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's what I thought. I was like, oh, I'm blanking on that third one. But great. Two rules. New rules. And yeah, then you do it. But here's the question. So then we get this kind of like additional thing that we'll talk about in a second. It sets up the story for Fallout 2. But what I want to ask you right now, Michael, about these Vault Boys is this the same like sense of humor of the Vault Boy from the previous game, or has the Vault Boy changed? Right, you know, listeners of the show, in the last episode we determined that Fallout 1, not a satire. The way that the Vault Boy is used, not satirical in any way. In Fallout 2, so far, in the first 2 minutes of the game that we've spent 11 minutes talking about, is the Vault Boy satirical?
Well, satirical, maybe, humorous, yes. Like, right out the gate, I think that this game is, I mean, at least at this point, right, much more aware of what it is doing with humor. It is much more kind of committed to the bit, even, of being humorous, whereas Fallout 1 was just wildly uneven in that regard. But, like, how this cinematic begins is, I said we're in a classroom, and there's, like, wartime propaganda on the walls, right? Like, buy war bonds and that sort of thing. And we watch this clip that begins with, you know, the little, like, countdown, and it also says something about, it's like, you know, declassified by Vault Tech or something along those lines. So already the game is doing world building here and, like, giving us a way of thinking about what this world was like and sort of, like, what, how, like, the humor here, right, is that this is a corporate educational short of the type that would have been shown in, you know, like a 1940s or 1950s classroom, that is about like how, like, now what you're going to do now that the world has been decimated by nuclear fire, right? Yes. and sort of like very flip and cavalier about it in a way that is clearly not appropriate.
Yes. Yeah. It is not equal to the disaster,
right? And then there's like, you know, oh, well, I mean, we'll get to this, I guess. I guess we're getting to it right now, but
it looks like we are.
Yeah. So then it like introduces, you know, the Garden of Eden creation kit as like, it's not really a rule, but it's like the third movement of those first two rules. Like, once you have left the vault, prepare to live life anew with the creation of a new world in the Garden of Eden creation kit. And then it shows you a shot of like, you know, the new world that you've always dreamed of living in. And it's just like, you know, some like very generic suburbs in upstate New York or something. That's just what it looks like. And then there's a little asterisk in the corner that says results may vary.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah. And it's like, that is that this is, I think, when we talk about Fallout humor, and we mean that kind of at its best, right? Like, that's kind of what we mean is the way that it is foregrounding the fact that this is like corporate, like pablum that is meant to sort of paper over the fact that these very same corporations have instigated and profited from the total destruction of the world.
Yeah. So again, maybe closer to parody, right? And like the weight of the parody is what kind of makes it work. Not satirical. So we get the Garden of Eden creation kit you're talking about, and then we cut to the people leaving the vault.
Yeah, we get have like the vault door opening, and we see that there is someone watching it, someone in a strange new type of power armor that we have not seen before, because it's 1998, and the only other Fallout game is Fallout 1.
Yeah, and the power armor that we have there is, you know, the Brotherhood of Steel stuff, which looks way different from this. This has kind of a more streamlined face mask. They've got these orange eyes that are very opaque.
It looks insectile.
Yeah, or alien,
like a,
even.
Yeah, it's like it looks very much modeled on like a wasp or something.
Yes, and so then there's this kind of implication immediately that you have, right, as if you've played the first game, of someone is developing new power armor. Which is cool. And so we see a vault door open, and it kind of slides over to the side, and then we have this like idyllic 1950s family who are like lit from behind their like almost like shadow puppet style. Mm-hmm. And they're waving, and then we cut to this figure in the power armor with a big, I don't even think we have the language for it yet, but a vertibird behind them, right?
Yeah.
This this kind of helicopter looking thing. And then this figure in the power armor kills them with a machine gun.
Yes, yeah, just like a minigun just starts firing. So again, mm-hmm. like that sort of dark Fallout humor that like here's this, presumably like these are people who have just watched this video that we've just seen, like that they have like prepared to come out of the vault and they're ready to live life anew, right? They're going to build the new world, and then the first thing, and they wave at the first person they see, and then they get mowed down by machine gun fire.
Yes. Right, so expectation and reality when they meet in the Fallout world seem to have some issues, and that's kind of like our first setup video. And then we have a holy second one.
Yeah, so I was going to say, like, continuing the tradition of the first game, this game opens three times.
Yeah, and I really wonder, we need to figure this out. I wonder if maybe the first one was released as a trailer beforehand,
mm-hmm.
you know, on either, like, a demo discs or something like that. Because I understand that probably, like, the Ron Perlman narration, that would probably not get re-released or released before. But that first one, it has all the pieces of promo, right? Like,
yes.
This is what you can expect. You can here's a new villain that you wouldn't be familiar with, mm-hmm. or a new faction, maybe. So yeah, I wonder about that. And then it just gets folded onto the disc, because why wouldn't you? But then we get our Ron Perlman narration, which is a little bit longer this time, and maybe a little bit too long to read. But do you have a general gist, Michael?
It's a weird opening, but not weird for the reasons the last game had a weird Ron Perlman opening. This opening to me is weird. He's like, so the world ended, and the quote specifically that he says is pretty much as we predicted.
Yep.
There's a very like, so you know, it's telling you there was a nuclear war. Like, it destroyed, like, it boiled the oceans, right? It nearly eradicated the entire human species, so on and so forth. But why it happened is sort of not really important to this narrator. It's for the reasons you would expect, that there were too few resources and too many people and not enough territory. And it's like, well, there's some thinking to be unpacked there, but the narrator is not interested in it. He calls he says, like, it was trivial and pointless, and the motivations were purely human.
Yep. I do think it's interesting. Yeah, quote, too many humans, not enough space or resources to go around. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of space and resources.
Yeah,
even now. It's they're perhaps unequally distributed. but yeah, so you know, we get nuclear war happen. Quote, continents were swallowed in flames and fell beneath the boiling oceans. I believe canonical to Fallout, that's what happened to Africa.
Oh.
The whole continent.
Oh.
Pretty sure that's in one of the Fallout Bibles, which is interesting. Yeah, and then just kind of like gives us what we know, right? So like gives us, you know, people hid in vaults and waited out, they came out. But then we shift registers, right? It's not just what happened during the Great War. Mm-hmm. It is then like what's happened between Fallout 1 and Fallout 2.
Yes. Because there is, how many years is it between the two games?
I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I can look, let me look at the Fallout timeline real quick. But yeah. I do know what it says here. Is that I think at the end of Ron Perlman's speech here, for a generation since its founding, because I believe that the old woman that we're going to talk about in just a minute, I think she's the vault dweller's daughter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so like one full generation.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and that makes, okay, that makes sense. So yeah, we get the sort of summary of what happened in Fallout 1 about the Vault Dweller, who gets now canonically realized as a he. So sorry, mm-hmm. Eleanor.
Yep. Rest in peace, Eleanor. Uh-huh. Gone but not forgotten, written out of canon.
but yeah, so the it specifically how this is introduced is among the quote-unquote northern tribes is where this story of the Vault Dweller begins and ends, right? The Vault Dweller from the first game has passed into legend. Someone who came out of the vaults and defeated a great evil that corrupted everything that it touched, and we see a picture of a super mutant, so we know that what is being referred to here is the Master and all that stuff. But the Vault Dweller, he was changed by his time outside of the vault, and so in the end, he was rejected even by his own people. He had become something different, something... He had become something else. He had become True Tonk, we can assume.
He was already True Tonk, and so he is post-truth Tonk.
Post-truth Tonk.
Yeah.
Very good. Very good. Anyway, so post-truth Tonk gets sent out into the wilderness, and he travels north into the canyons, the Great Canyons, and founds a village called Arroyo. And this is your home. So we get that turn back to kind of the tabletop style intro.
Yeah. And then that's kind of it, right?
Yeah. Well, we also like see, we get a little shot of the, like the shrine that is set up to the Vault Dweller, which is weird because it looks kind of, hellish.
Oh, it's rad. Like, the art direction in this game is so good.
it's like this horn, and there's, like, it might be barbed wire or something all wrapped around it, and we have the Fallout, or the Vault Dweller's, like, jumpsuit draped over it.
And it's, like, being held up above the shrine, being kind of suspended with this bone or something. Yeah, that's holding it up. It is cool. You do kind of wonder, like, where the aesthetics of this tribe comes from. So here we can see, like, all kinds of, interesting stuff going on. And some, like, I would say science fiction trope stuff, right? Which follows on from the first game, right? So the first one, I think this is one that's really... really prominent, unavoidable. We got to talk about it at least for a second. Uh-huh. There's this idea, right? That there are, you know, kind of stages of human development, right? So you get, you get small government. You get hunter-gatherers first, and then you get, It starts with small government, and the protection of the people. That falls apart. You get hunter-gatherers. No, but the idea here, like hunter-gatherers, then you get agriculture, and then you get the formation of small government, and then you get, I don't know, democracy or whatever, and then you get, like, contemporary, good old, the state, like capital S state, right?
Right. At some point you, like, pass through monarchy or something.
Exactly. Yeah, you get the, basically, just imagine the way that government works in civilization games, and that, like, this is like our fantasy of how these things work, right? So in science fiction, for a long time, but especially kind of post-nuclear war science fiction, wrote a bunch of my dissertation on this, there's this kind of fantasy of once nuclear war happens, what we do is we do what human beings, like, do all the time, which is that we just regress back to... Basically, we have to start over in our development. Okay, so right. We're wasteland wanderers, and then after we're wasteland wanderers, we can become like small village owners,
right?
Much like a small business owner, but we enter in back into like tribes, and this is in quotation marks, right? But basically, what this does, right, is that it puts indigenous Americans and indigenous groups in general, it basically says, like, indigenous groups are just frozen in time, and they are a stage of human history that has to be passed through in order to get to, like, the modern liberal democratic state.
Right, and, like, for whatever reason, they have failed to move forward in time in the correct way.
Exactly. And so, that's just racist.
Yep.
Like, the assumption itself is incorrect. Like there are no progressive stages of human history. There's no progress narrative to human history. There's just people adapting to their material conditions. I think to some extent Fallout 1 does a better job of this, weirdly enough, because it is like, I guess we live in the junkyard, and so we're junk town, you know, and I guess this is the hub, and so I guess we're going to have, like, industry here in the necropolis, you know, being water exporters in that one thing. But this kind of, that Fallout 2 immediately starts with this trope of, after Wasteland wanders, then we will become tribal again in our kind of slow climbing of the ladder of human history one more time.
Right.
And that's just like hot garbage. Right. That's like it's, not a thing.
It just, it's so absurd and it makes no sense because the Vault Dweller came out of a vault, like had, you know, some sort of enculturation to him, but yet none of that is really evident in the society that he founded.
No, and right. In Arroyo, I mean, we're going to see this next episode, and we'll talk about it again, but in Arroyo, we're going to see, like a straight-up shaman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be, like, a weird... I mean, he's, like, a weird... what, his name's Hakunin, I think?
Something like that.
It's something like that, but, I mean, he's just, like, almost a parody of, like...
Yes.
American native stuff. Like, mm-hmm. Whatever that imagination conjures for you and its genericism, that is what this is. Which is kind of a huge missed opportunity, I think, because if there's anything that California had pre-war, it would have been... Well, you know, the timeline doesn't necessarily match up, but I think we could fudge it for the sake of the game. You could have, like, a weirdo hippie.
Right. Well, so, like, the talking about in the last game, the settlement around L.A. of Adytum, right? Like, that apparently named after a real kind of esoteric society that operates in that area, which is very much like, you know, the West Coast 60s, 70s, New Agey kind of religion aspect that clearly some of these developers knew existed or exists.
Yeah, so you're just leaving good narrative on the ground, I think, if you don't do it. But so they choose to kind of go back to this tribal trope mm-hmm. in science fiction, which is a common trope in science fiction. You know, even the what do you call it? Your favorite science fiction book,
Canticle for Leibowitz.
Yeah, it kind of uses this trope.
Yes, nope. It has like the what they call the horse lords.
Hell yeah. That's cool. Horse lords are cool. but yeah, so we're going to see that, you know, and we'll talk about it a bit as it comes up. But that's just kind of like background radiation for this whole section of the game. And actually for quite a bit coming through. I mean, we're going to meet Sulik later in the game, who's got that kind of stuff going on too. He's you know, we'll talk about it when we get there. There's some much like throughout the rest of Fallout, every game we play from here on out, some unfortunate racial stereotypes and like weird, not even just racial stereotypes, but like, it's the police. They're coming to get me talking about it. It's the man.
They're trying to suppress us. Patreon.com/rangetouch. Only you can support the truth.
But it's almost like this like science fiction and fantasy, or really science fiction uniting of real world ethnicity with like weird sci-fi values that then gets replicated in science fiction. So I wouldn't even say it's like a real ethnic stereotype. It's like the weird fictional thing that happens when you take real world ethnicity and like do other things with it in sci-fi. We're going to talk about that quite a bit. That's a really common, I don't think there's very much that's happening in this game that's like, that feels weird, that is not straight out of something from post 45 science fiction. So it's not like this is a unique cultural object in that way. In any case, we find that, you know, we learned about the Vault Dweller doing all this stuff through Ron Perlman. I almost said Ron Jeremy for some reason, but Ron Perlman. But here, hold on. What if Ron Jeremy did the intro to Fallout?
In a way, that would be a very Fallout 2 move.
And it would be a very 90s move, too. Yes. Real combo. But we do that, and we basically then move into character creation, right? It dumps us back into the main menu. And then
don't we get the old woman before that?
No, nope. It's when you start the game.
Oh, okay. So we do character creation, then old woman. All right. Yes.
Yep. So tell me about your character, Michael.
So Over the last week or so, I have been re-listening to your previous show, Mages and Murder Dads, that you did with Danny about the Baldur's Gate games and that lineage. And there was something that was said early on in the first season of Mages and Murder Dads by you that I realized was very applicable to my own experience with Too Much Future, which was that you had kind of started playing the first Baldur's Gate game for that show as you would have, like, not consciously, but you had started playing it as you would have played it as a little tween or teen, where you just kind of didn't know how to build a character and ended up with something that was incredibly unworkable for a good portion of the game. Check out Mages and Murder Dads. It's a good time. Anyway, I realized that I had done sort of the same thing with Eleanor in the last game. In that I had wanted to play a certain type of character, but it turned out, which was like sort of sneaky and shooty and smart and able to, like, you know, talk her way out of things or sneak around things, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of turned out that the game does not lend itself to that kind of play consistently. And so by the end of the game, I had this character who I had originally built to play one way, and I was just like funneling all of my level ups into desperately trying to figure out how to make her use big guns and explosives and things, because I was getting into just like, I was getting into so many combat situations I could not sneak or talk my way out of.
Sometimes you gotta pivot.
Yeah. So with all that sort of behind me, I decided that this character was going, I was going to consciously build a character who would not sort of fully be funneled into the soft options, right? Have a little more combat stuff maybe built in, but I was going to more conscientiously try to, because presumably, I'm hoping, this game has better balance in this regard, play a character who is stealthy and sneaky and charismatic. So, yes, this is how I have decided that in my own, in the timeline that I exist in my playthrough, the Vault Dweller was Eleanor, and her descendant, Twelinor, which is just Eleanor with a two at the beginning. She is not very strong, not horribly perceptive. She's like middling perceptive. She doesn't have high endurance, but she has very high charisma. This is the thing that I've decided to do. Rather, I think last time I was really high on agility and intelligence. Twelinor is she's got a 10 on charisma. I've decided to give her the full, you know, amount that I reasonably could there. Reasonably high intelligence of 7. My thinking, right, is that so many of the things that happened with Eleanor was she was smart enough to say things, but then people would just want to kill her for it. So maybe if I lean more toward the charisma side, I can say things and people will not just think that I'm an asshole and then aggro me. And sort of middling high agility and, you know, four luck, because whatever. Then the tagged skills I chose were sneak, speech, and barter.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, because I decided I want to be rich.
Okay.
And I guess they're called perks, but they're not called perks exactly when you start, but that's what they functionally are.
Yeah.
I went with skilled. That gave me more skill points to put into things. And one-hander. That gives me an advantage with one-handed guns.
And disadvantage with
and disadvantage with two-handed. Yeah, so I am not going to, hopefully, not going to have to swing into, like, carrying around a giant plasma rifle.
Well, it seems like a good character. Seems hopefully like good stuff. It's interesting you went with charisma, but you didn't go for sex appeal.
That's weird.
Sex appeal is weird, but also, so for people who don't know, so there, you know, there are all of these, yeah, I guess perks that you can choose at the beginning of the game, and there's like 12 of them or something, or 14. There's a fair number, maybe even 20, and you get to choose two, and some of them are, like the ones that Michael just said, are like just straight up gameplay or straight up mechanical kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like additional skill points, better at one-handed weapons. But some of them are just like a little bit more nebulous about what they do. So, for example, there's Bloody Mess. Bloody Disgusting is like a website.
Yes.
Bloody Mess just makes all of the like death animations much more brutal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's it. And sometimes there's like worse outcomes. Sex Appeal is another one of those like more nebulous ones that just says like the opposite sex finds you more attractive and the same sex finds you or like is more competitive with you.
Mm-hmm.
Which obviously naturalizes heterosexuality, number one. But on the other end, very unclear about what it does. But it does have like big effects later in the game. You can sleep your way through several quests in this game. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't think I ever did that playthrough. Actually, no, I did. I did do that. Okay, never mind. Yes. I did do some of that in my previous experiences, and I was reflecting on, I guess, these various traits, and I did not go with sex appeal, primarily because it just would feel very weird to me to be here in public talking about, yeah, no, and then I, like, created this female character, and then I had her sleep her way through the game.
Look, I'm not telling you how to play the game. I'm just saying.
Yeah. You're just like, oh, it's interesting you didn't choose sex appeal. And it's like, yeah. What the hell does sex appeal even mean in this context?
Like, so I was very close to picking it. Like, extremely close to picking it.
Ooh, handsome but, tonk grandson.
Exactly. That was my thought, right? Is that, you know, you can have, like, a sexy tonk, and he's, like, good. He carries around a hammer, and he, you know, he's like Conan, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately didn't go with that. So what I went with is my character, if people listen to Fallout or Fallout 1 season of Too Much Future, you know that at the end, Tonk managed to, through various different mystical and science fictional means, transcend his bloodline and become a god on the earth. And that meant that he could destroy his enemies and save his allies in ways that were unthinkable. He had all the power of the universe in one single pinky toe, all that kind of stuff. And what's important about that is that it fundamentally warped his DNA. Okay? like there's no one... Tonk could not have a child that was not in some ways affected by his transformation into true Tonk. Tungsten, who is his grandson, Tungsten has a strength of 9. He's got a perception of 7 and an agility of 7. So, a lot of action points and hits things pretty hard, but also has an intelligence of 5.
Just a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. But very unlucky. Extremely unlucky.
Oh dear.
Took for tags for skills in the same way, right? His kind of essential knowledge, his talents, come from of course Tonk's ability to use melee weapons real good. So got melee weapons in there, but then energy weapons. Grew up being told about the energy weapons of the world, very interested in it, and then here's a real curveball: science.
Okay.
Because sometimes you got to do research to figure out how to find the character editor. And that seems scientific to me.
Okay, yeah. Need to gaze beyond the boundaries of reality and so on and so forth.
Exactly. Rationalism works by seeming to transcend its limits and then reestablishing those limits. And that's exactly how Tungsten is going to operate. So that's what he's got going on. And then for perks or whatever they're called, heavy-handed, which just deals more melee damage, but fewer critical hits. But lo and behold, if you've got a real low luck, it does not matter because you're never going to crit anyway. I think I have a 2% chance, so whatever. Who cares? But it literally doubled my melee damage. Very beginning of the game, Tungsten is doing like 14 damage with that spear, which is real good. And then this is the fun one. And this was, I went back and forth between this and Sex Appeal, but I thought that, that this would be better because Tungsten's grandfather, Tonk, True Tonk, fundamentally altered the space-time continuum by his very existence. Tungsten is jinxed. That means that
the bloodline.
Exactly. Cursed DNA. Cursed what are those things called? The little individual DNA strands. Gosh, you know what I'm talking about, right?
I guess so, yes.
Okay. Anyway, cursed dino DNA.
Dino DNA.
But jinxed, what it does is it, everyone in the world has more critical failures. But so do you.
We live in a fallen world.
Yeah. And so I thought that would be funny. And it's already paid out. So if people who are watching the feed, when you see me running through and, you know, I only have, because as far as actual gameplay that we did here, we only did like 30 minutes maximum of game. So you're going to see some of the same footage kind of rolling through more than once. You are going to see multiple ants breaking their own legs trying to attack me. you're going to see all kinds of bugs hurting themselves trying to hurt me. And so that's fun. But yeah, so that's what Tungsten is up to. I hit that button to save the game and to move on, and we see an old lady. Mm-hmm. What is she about?
She's like, chosen one. That's you. You're the chosen one.
Yeah.
Which is not the most compelling of player character designations. But it's 1998. I suppose we can forgive it. We see this old woman. She is like sitting in some dark area with a table before her. On this table is a revolver, and to her left behind her is a massive bong.
It's huge. I do not... It blows my mind. It's a massive blue bong. I don't know who thought that they needed to have that in there, but anyway.
Classic Fallout. It's just there. She's got like a gun and a bong, and it makes me feel like, oh, I've just wandered back into Eastern Indiana somewhere. But anyhow, she tells you that everything's dying. Crops are failing, the Brahmin are dying, children are getting sick, everything's going bad for some unknown reason. For some reason, this region, which I guess up until now has been pretty arable, like you know, this society has lived there for give or take 100 years, a generation, whatever. Now it's just suddenly dying. And the old woman tells you, there's this thing called the Garden of Eden Creation Kit. You need to go get one of those.
Yeah. Particularly, she says, like, the children are dying, and then shows these two, like, bald children who just look exactly like her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think this might just be what people look like, old lady. I'm sorry. Sorry to report that people just look bad. But yeah, so everything's bad. Go find the Garden of Eden Creation Kit. Bring it back here. Save the family farm. Hop to it.
Mm-hmm.
Go play the tutorial.
Oh yeah, she's like, go to the Temple of Trials and prove yourself. And it's like, ah, the Temple of Trials. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Temple Trials is it's a tutorial dungeon, like straight up, and it's three screens, each of which just has you learning how to do the various different things of like a Fallout game, right? Mm-hmm. So the first one really introduces you to combat. There's some giant ants you gotta fight and giant scorpion. There's some places to loot, and then there's like a door you gotta pick the lock.
Yes.
So you gotta learn how combat works in the game. You gotta learn how to use a little skill menu, and you gotta learn like what it means to loot stuff.
Yep.
And that's about it.
Yep. For a while, I was pretty confused because I forgot that you had to contextually pick the lockpick skill out of the little skill menu. And the door was just like, when you click on the door, it's just like, this door is locked. And I'm like, oh, okay, there's a key somewhere I have to find. But this is not a big area. So I could not find any sort of key. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? How has the tutorial dungeon defeated me? But no, it was like, oh, right, you have to pick lockpick from your little thing. And because it's 1998 and this is how games work.
Yep, yep. You got to go to it. You got to do it. You go into the second one. Immediately, you're beset by traps, which is great. There's all these traps on the floor. You can manually avoid them, or you can just run over them and shoot spears at you.
Yes.
They hurt real bad.
They do. They do. Twelinor is not great at disabling traps, but by God, if she can stand there and just poke at it again and again and again, eventually it goes in her favor and the trap is disabled. So that works.
Persistence. It's a big part of valor. more scorpions, more ants. You're running around. This one, in order to get out of it, you have to loot a little container. You got to find a brick of plastic explosives that have been preserved for years and years. You got to set that timer. Wait, what'd you say?
Oh, I said plastic, man. It just, you know, it's a hyper object.
No, thank you. and then you have to say, this is again teaching you how to do stuff, right? So, like, you go into the menu, you got to set the timer, you drop the thing, you run away, and it blows up this, like, bricked in door. And that's a very useful skill. We're actually going to be able to use explosives a few more times over the course of this game. Good to know. Also, here you can find a dead body that has a spear on it, like some bones. So people died down here, and the bugs have been eating them. Then you can go into the third screen.
Yeah, can we pause for just
a
moment? I just want to make it clear, and I don't know, maybe this was your experience too, but combat in this game is infinitely more tolerable than it was in the previous game.
It's a lot smoother, and I couldn't figure out if that was just because I have spent, you know, I just played the first game. Why do you think it's a little more smooth for you?
I don't know, right? That's what's weird, is that functionally the system is not different. It hasn't, like, the even like the UI is basically the same. There have been some slight cosmetic changes, but just like the experience of like choosing to attack a thing and then attacking it and moving around the map just feels less janky. It feels like, honestly, it feels like Fallout 1 was just a tech demo for Fallout 2 in this weird way. Like they realized after the fact, like, oh yeah, the combat should actually work.
Yeah, there is something to, like, something about the way the animations are playing, the speed at which the combat goes. There is something going on. And it might just be that there are more combat animations straight up. And so it's just a little more naturalistic. It looks and feels closer to what we associate with a tactics game now.
Yes.
You know, further along the kind of gradation of fidelity or something like that. And I think probably one reason for that is it appears that there are three times as many staff for this game. You know, if you're looking at the opening credits, three times as many staff for this game as the original Fallout. So probably there's just a lot more time to work on that kind of thing. I didn't know. I also found it more smooth. Because I have more action points, just like a couple more action points. And that means that at the beginning of the game, Tonk is getting to attack twice a turn instead of once a turn. And that, like, really did speed things up. But he's also spearing these giant ants for, like, 14, 15 damage at a go as they are breaking their arms and legs while trying to attack him. So that has a big, you know, that probably had an effect, too, on my experience. But yeah, absolutely. I agree that combat's a lot better. I also increased my combat speed at the beginning of the game just a little bit. So that probably helped as well. But then we go into the third room or third area level of the Temporal Trials. And very similar spot. You know, you're running through it. There's ants, there's scorpions, things like that. I'm killing all of these as I go by because I'm trying to get them levels.
Yep.
Tonk needs them levels, as we know, as the saga of True Tonk has taught us for years and years. And at the end of this one, there's
you
a there's
very
a guy,
special friend.
Yeah, there's a guy standing there. He's got a name, but I don't know what it is.
His name is Cameron.
Is that true?
Yes.
Oh my god. Metal Gear.
Which
brother?
Which is it's a great little continuation of the bizarre Fallout practice of welcome to our post-apocalyptic society. My name's Cameron.
Uh-huh.
Like,
and here's our friend Hakunin.
Right? Like we are a bunch of people who like live in tents in a canyon and like yeah, have names like Hakunin.
We all have Geico assistant manager names.
Yes.
Me and Eric hang out all the time.
So yeah, no. So the yeah, we meet Cameron.
Mm-hmm. But but yeah, so he's like, hey, check this out. We gotta fight unarmed combat. And the mm-hmm. reason for that is sometimes you can't sneak your way out of something. Sometimes you can't stealth your way out of it. Sometimes you can't charm your way out of it, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I guess basically the implication here is that you could theoretically have snuck through the entirety of the rest of this. And they want to make sure that you can do combat.
Mm-hmm.
That is my assumption. And that's kind of the way that it's narratively told. You can ask him, or I could ask him several questions, but I couldn't like talk my way out of it. Did Twelinor have the ability to talk her way out of it?
Yes,
great,
and it is
great.
it is like the weirdest, weakest way of talking your way out of a combat situation ever, because it's you know, I don't have the exact dialogue options memorized, but basically Twelinor was like, do we really need to do this? Like, we could both get really hurt.
Oh wow.
You know,
that's very reasonable.
One of us might die. And Cameron is like, you know what? You're right. Like, one of us might die in unarmed hand-to-hand combat. So, yeah, I'm just going to let you out.
I mean, that is correct, I guess.
Yeah, it is correct. But it makes me wonder about Cameron's commitment to being assigned, you know, this particular position in the Tower, or the Tower of Trials, the Temple of Trials. Just because it's like, okay, so what's going to happen is the Chosen One's going to get to the end here and you're going to have to defeat them in hand-to-hand combat. And the Chosen One shows up and it's like, do you really have to do that, though?
Yeah, I think his commitment is almost zero.
Yes.
I mean, I think one person a generation does this. I think they'll be okay if they don't get through with the unarmed combat. Again, here's a great example of the two different paths you can take in this game.
Mm-hmm.
So Twelinor very cleverly talks her way out of it, or well, marginally cleverly, depending on how you how you take it. And Tongston said okay, and then proceeded to kick him in the groin with targeted unarmed kicking attacks until he gave up. So literally it was like unarmed punch, one punch, did a little bit of damage, and I was like, oh wait, I'm pretty sure if I don't have a weapon equipped, if I hit the weapon switch button, it goes from punching to kicking. So it's like kick, targeted, target the groin, 50% chance, boom, and it's like this massive blow of like 12 hit points of damage. And because I think the game's taking it a little bit easy on us, right, because I think I got two turns for every one turn that any of the enemies got. It might have to do with sequencing too, but so it was like kick in the groin, immediately get a turn again, targeted kick in the groin, knocked him prone, and then he stood up and he was like, you win. You're good. I'm completely good. And so I thought that was that was a very appropriate thing. I'm going to be honest. I mean, it is the juvenile gamer in me. Anytime I can hit any creature of any sort in the groin with a melee weapon or with an unarmed attack, I'm going to do it. like I'm Johnny Cage. The world is Goro, and I'm going for it.
Shout out. So the Mortal Kombat movie.
Yeah, which is also, I think, what, that's 96, I think?
Yeah, something like that. And also, we were recording a different show yesterday, and we discussed Paul W.S. Anderson, so...
Yeah. Wait,
keep
did
an
he
eye
do
out
the first
for
one?
Our Paul W.S. Anderson podcast, I guess.
Yeah. Did wait, Paul W.S. Anderson did the first Mortal Kombat film?
I am pretty sure.
I know he did Annihilation. I mean, I believe you. I just didn't know that.
I'm going to double check that now.
Okay, let's find
this,
out.
The Paul W.S. Anderson podcast begins now.
It's a sub-podcast.
Yeah, no, he did Mortal Kombat in 95.
Dang, that movie's good. Holds up. I've seen it recently, and it's still pretty good. But yeah, and so we made it through. You get another shot of, this time a cinematic, of that Vault 13 jumpsuit hanging in the thing. It's you know, fully rendered. We're zooming in through this temple, and then fades to black, fades back in, and we are standing in the middle of the village of Arroyo, wearing the Vault 13 Vault Dweller costume, ready to go on a quest. And I immediately walked two steps south. There's a well in the middle of town, much like the well in that Tonk could not move back to Vault 13. And I hit the repair button and repaired it and got 100 experience. It's 100 free experience for you.
Oh, wow. I didn't even realize it was broken. I was just like, yep, that's a well. Didn't even look at it.
I just remembered that off the bat. And I think that like a very low repair skill can still repair it. So it's 100 free experience. I leveled up, put some more points into all my tag skills, and got ready for next episode when we're actually going to start Fallout 2.
Hooray!
Hooray! Any final thoughts about this first little bit, Michael?
Here's a question for you. Mm-hmm. What the ever-loving hell is the Temple of Trials? Like, what was this place before the war?
Oh, I think they built it.
The people in Arroyo built this?
There's no explanation for it other than that, right?
Like, yes, right? Like, you are correct. There is no explanation for it other than that. But it is an explanation that just defies all common sense, because it is like this massive fantasy-style temple with, like, it reminds me actually of the set design of the Joel Schumacher Batman films, because there are like these sort of weird art deco like figures all around, and it's just like, what, like, I to me, right, it feels like this place had to exist before the war because of the sort of like just the breadth of it, like what it is. And yet
so there's like one part where it's sunken and under there's like a hole in the ground, and you can see this like weird spiky structure in it.
Yeah,
so looking at the Temple of Trials here on the Fallout Wiki, let me give you two pieces of information that don't have citations, but you know, take them how you will. Okay, number one, people don't like this tutorial. And in fact, I remember when the game came out, people making mods that allowed you just to straight up skip it. Mm-hmm. In the same way they do that for Baldur's Gate 2 as well. They were forced to do this tutorial by Interplay, who wanted to make sure they had it, you know, so the publisher of the game. Okay. Two, the structures, this is in the section behind the scenes on the official, not the official, but the Fallout fan wiki. The structures in the pit, in the passage section, like the spike tower and the stone face, come from Planescape Torment. So that explains some of the stuff. And it does, though, those are very tormenty looking.
Yeah. Huh. Well, so here starts like the next thread for this show, which is going to be arguing that Torment and Fallout 2 actually share a continuity.
Well, what do you call it? The City of Doors can take you anywhere, Michael.
Uh-huh.
So that's how it goes.
Yeah. So that was something I wanted to discuss, the absolute weirdness of the Temple of Trials.
Yeah, and it looks like there's a section of the Fallout Bible about this. So I think what we're going to do, people have been asking about the Fallout Bible, and I've mentioned it a couple times. If you don't know what that is, the Fallout Bible is a series of like forum posts, I believe, that Chris Avellone did in the early 2000s. And I remember like reading them as they were coming out too, which is very exciting. But basically it was during the prep for Fallout 3 before like the Bethesda Fallout mm-hmm. 3 stuff. So it was, what if Black Isle did Fallout 3?
Right, during the Van Buren stage.
Yeah, so it's called Van Buren. If you hear us talk about Van Buren over the course of these episodes, that's what's going to be. But so Fallout Bible is like basically this world-building document that was being developed while they were working on Van Buren. And so there are things in the Fallout Bible that were assumptions that were made for Van Buren that just are non-canonical at this point, because the reason why they would have happened that didn't happen, you know, didn't exist, right?
Yeah.
So all to say, I think what we're going to do is we're going to play Fallout 2, we're going to finish that up, and then we're going to do a one-off episode where we just like read all the Fallout Bible, which doesn't take very long, and then we'll just talk about it, and we'll talk about all the different kinds of logics and things like that behind it. So if there's something really cool in the Fallout Bible that you wish that we had context for this game, we'll get there. But that seems like the best use of our time, as opposed to like trying to read it, you know, episode by episode, or read it selectively, which would be very hard to do, I think. Michael, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Warren is Dead.
You can find me on Twitter at C Kunzelman. If you enjoy the show and you would like to support it, you can go to patreon.com/rangedtouch. You can also go to twitter.com/rangedtouch and rangedtouch.com. All of those are down in the description below this episode. If you're watching this on YouTube and you would like to have it as a podcast, you can support us on the Patreon for $3 a month. That'll give you access to a podcast feed and all kinds of other goodies that we're doing. If you support at $5 a month, you get a little Let's Play that I've been working on in secret and some other stuff too. So that's very, very exciting. We'll be back in 2 weeks with the next episode of the show. This show will probably, or this season, I should say, of Too Much Future will probably take about double the time of Fallout 1, I think. I think it's about two times the size. And so we're in this for the next little while, probably through the summer, I would assume. But so if you have any questions about it, feel free to leave those down in the comments below or to put them in the Discord. In the Too Much Future little chat room in the Discord. If you want to join the Range Touch Discord, just go down to the description below this episode and click that little linky button, and it'll take you right there, and you'll do it. Any final thoughts here, Michael?
No, unless you mean the sign off.
Well, do we have a better sign off, or we have the same one?
I guess it's probably the same one.
All right, give it to us.
War never changes, but Fallout sure does.
Everything changed when the boss fell, except for